Welcome to The Commentary. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church.
And I'm Cameron Brooks. I'm a poet and a musician at Grace. The Commentary is a weekly conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace.
And in this episode, we're going to be talking about one of the new things that is happening in our Grace community as Sunday school has begun again for the fall. We're embarking on a new adventure in adult Sunday school. We spent several years working through the Westminster Confession of Faith. I don't know if I thought we would ever finish, but we did. And so as we come back to Sunday school this fall, we're embarking on a new journey, which is a study of early church history. It's called The First 500 Years, and as the title suggests, we're looking at the first 500 years of the church and studying some of the pivotal events, some of the things that developed over that time, some of the great controversies and challenges, and hopefully getting to know some of the important figures from that time as well. It's something I've wanted to do for quite a while, but it's something a little bit unlike anything that we've done before. So very exciting and very nerve-wracking at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to say terrifying. I am very excited, and I don't have to teach, so I'm even more excited. I get to sit back and enjoy the show. I'm very curious, how are you going to go about choosing our focuses for each lesson? There's so much that we could talk about. Obviously, we've got our big figures, our councils. We're going to hit on those.
Right.
But how are you thinking about the syllabus, I guess, for this course?
Now, it's a great question. I would say, in my experience, that when people teach church history, they either do it at too high a level and get through too quickly, or with so much detail that it feels like you will never progress at all.
Yeah.
You know, and it's true for the books. You know, if you read most church history books, I think they're great on maybe overarching narrative and giving you the high points. But if you have specific questions about that time period, a lot of times they're not addressed in those narratives. A lot of times the controversies are not unpacked, and the authors just give you maybe their view of what must have taken place. And so what we're trying to do is something that's somewhere in the middle. So it's not so broad brush that it's just hitting the highlights. We will take a little bit of time to go into detail on some things, but it's also not so, you know, dense and dry that it's impossible to keep going, you know, to maintain your interest. I did make a promise that, unlike the Westminster Confession, this isn't going to be a years-long thing, that my hope is that we will get through the first 500 years in two semesters. So by next summer, this will be behind us, Lord willing. What that means, though, is that I have to kind of make some decisions as we go about when to speed up and when to slow down, when to, you know, advance the narrative and when to look at a theme. And I honestly, I don't know exactly how that's going to work out because I've not taught this before. As I said in the first class, the introduction, it's something I've always wanted to do because I wanted to be a historian. You know, I imagined being like a history professor or something. This is my chance, I guess. But sometimes wannabe historians are the worst historians. And so we're trying to do this in a way where it's interesting and useful, not just for history nerds, but for anyone who is interested in this period. But also, let me say it a little bit differently, interesting for people who are not interested in the history of this period, because that's kind of the point. I think this is an important history for Christians to know about, regardless of how interested they are in history, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking back to, I think it was your first session where you brought up a what was the quote? Is it John Henry Newman?
Yes. To be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant.
Yeah. Which is a startling quote, but I disagree with it.
Of course.
And I disagree with it for the reasons that you gave, and we'll probably get to that. And yet, I think sometimes Protestants can forget about this period or overlook it because we have the early church in the book of Acts and we have the Reformation.
Right.
And Reformation theologians. We've got Paul, and then there was some stuff that happened for 500 years. There's Constantine, there's the fall of Rome. Then there's like the medievals, and those guys were weird. And then Luther and Calvin saved us from that strange period. And it's, you know, a terrible history from a Protestant perspective. But I do think that we don't know, we speaking generally for Protestants here, and don't know the patristics, these early church fathers and mothers, like we could.
And we don't know them the way the Reformers did. And I think
that's kind
of the key is that it's very easy, and this is true in the 21st century across the board, you know, whether you're talking about Protestants, Roman Catholics, whoever, everybody assumes that the Reformation was a break from the historic church to create something new, which would have been really surprising to the Reformers, who saw themselves doing just the opposite. What they thought had happened is the church had broken from the past and needed to reconnect with it, needed to reform itself to be more in line with what it was meant to be. And so you can, you know, agree or disagree with what they did, but if you want to understand their movement according to its own terms, you have to recognize that and see that, like, for example, if you've read Calvin, if you read Calvin's Institutes, he's constantly interacting with church fathers, early, sometimes medieval. Like there's no discontinuity. It's not an end in the conversation. And that's a very different attitude towards the past than is true oftentimes in like a modern evangelical setting, where the way that you like work around or cope with the lack of knowledge is to say something like, well, the early church was great, but we don't know what that was like, but it was probably basically like the church today. But then Constantine came along and he ruined it and corrupted it. And then the Reformation, they kind of fixed it, or at least started the process to where we get to like modern evangelicalism.
Yeah.
And so you kind of do an end run and tell yourself that at the beginning it was like it is now, and then there was this problem in between, but because it was a problem, I don't need to know much about it. And the difficulty with that way of thinking about history is that a lot of the things that we hold to be true, a lot of the doctrine that we believe is essential to Christianity, is formulated during the period that you are writing off when you do your history that way. And so you have to reckon with it, and you have to think about what that means. Now, the other reality is a lot of the things that people say, you know, our corruptions that enter the church after Constantine are present in some form prior to Constantine. And so, again, just the dates don't work on some of those things as well. So what we want to do is a kind of warts and all history, right? It's not going to be a sectarian, let's go back and see how everybody was actually Presbyterian. It's going to be more like this is what it was really like, to the extent that we're able to answer questions about it, you know, and these are the things that we have in common with those churches. And we'll also talk about where are the areas where there seem to be differences, and why are there differences, and is that okay? And, you know, we'll talk through some of those things, but my hope is not to just whitewash everything, not to paper over the real differences, but also to get to the point where there's enough understanding to where you can see that everybody faces these challenges, not just Protestants.
Right.
Right. That a lot of times the everybody makes claims about the early church, and as long as you don't know much about the history of the early church, those claims can sound really convincing, whether they're Roman Catholic claims that we're the original church and we do everything the way they did it, or, you know, fundamentalist Baptist claims that there's been this secret line of Baptist churches all throughout history, and we're the ones who are doing what the New Testament church did. But the more you know, the more those claims become complicated.
Yeah.
Right? And you start seeing the real work. So that's part of what we want to do, is we want to have enough knowledge where when people make claims, we know enough to say, well, actually, wait a second, hold on, I'm not so sure about that. But there's a larger goal, and we share this with our series on the Westminster Confession. When we did the Westminster Confession, I said, we're not doing this first and foremost to learn doctrine. We're doing it first and foremost for, quote, unquote, devotional purposes. We want to know God better. We want to have more insight into his ways and what Scripture teaches. And this is the same. By studying the history of the church, we develop a providential sense of history. We start seeing the way that God does things in time. And we start seeing his faithfulness to his people over generations. And we also see the dysfunction of those people over generations as well, you know, and there's a lot that we can relate to, both in the failure of the believers and also the faithfulness of their God.
Yeah. You know, when we release this episode, I think we'll be a few weeks out from today, but I'm thinking of our most recent session where we talked about Eusebius, right?
Right,
and his
right.
view of what you just called providential history. I think it's fascinating to, it shouldn't be fascinating to have to view history as a Christian as a canvas of God's works, right? Mm. God is working in history. It's not just a random series of events. It's not just the works of men. But sometimes that's how we think about history, even church history. We look back and we say, well, there's a lot of stuff that happened. Let's sort it all out and try to get to motives, look at the controversies, forgetting that we actually confess that God works in all things and that he's working in yes, this very sordid, strange, sometimes process. And so I appreciated that we started there, and I'm going to try to keep that in mind as we progress, because I know that things can get ugly. That's history. Things get ugly. But that doesn't mean God has ceased to work. It just means that we can't always predict how God is going to work.
Yeah, and I think knowing the history gives you like more confidence in those things, right? That it, in a sense, it helps a little bit with our inferiority complex. I think in the 21st century, if you're a Christian, you can't help but feel like you fall short in comparison with those who went before you. When we think about, for example, the work of the great ecumenical councils, right, and producing the creeds that we still recite today, those men in our eyes seem like giants. The Westminster Divines, the same way. And we look back and they're like, they seem almost superhuman to us. I wouldn't dream of getting together a modern group of theologians and asking them to make a 21st century Westminster Confession. I would be horrified at the thought of what might happen when you got them all together in the room. And so we assume that those men must have been of a different order than men today. And becoming more acquainted with the history, you begin to realize, oh, wait, no. So it wasn't that the men were better. It's God working in them and through them, or even sometimes in spite of them.
Yeah.
And so it the more you realize their circumstances resemble our circumstances in a lot of ways that surprise you, the more you realize they relied on God the way we rely on God, and he did great things through them and would do great things through us, you know, and that there's a dependence that runs through the history of the church. So I think those are things that knowing more about the history can actually help, because we do tend to have that almost hagiographic view of those who went before us. And, you know, when you see, as I say, how the sausage is made, your first reaction is disillusionment. You know, you think, wait, what? What? There was politics involved at the Council of Nicaea? Are you telling me they didn't just walk into a room and pray in silence and then every man understood and was on the same page? Like, I think that can be really tough for us at first. But then you begin to realize, okay, so it was always God. It wasn't just that they used to breed churchmen better in the old days or something like that, you know? So that's, I think, one of the big benefits that we will see, you know, that over the course of this. But I don't know. I think also it may give us a better appreciation for the past as well, because one of the things I argued right at the beginning was that as we study church history, even the controversies, you know, and of course, the controversies go right back to the beginning. You know, the New Testament even is full of these controversies, that as you study the way that, you know, different views were propagated and people who should have been on the same page were at each other's throat. I don't know. I think you get an appreciation for how God did things over time, how doctrine developed and progressed, and also how this idea of the need to reform according to Scripture was always present in the church and was not just something made up at the Reformation. And I think oftentimes that's how it is, right? There's this assumption that, you know, until the Reformation, tradition just ran wild and the church just kept reinventing itself. But actually, there were always these moves pushing back. There were always these rediscoveries of what Scripture said and attempts to bring the practice of the church back into line with the teachings of Scripture. And so while, of course, we're going to see a lot of things in that history that do not seem to be according to Scripture, we're also going to see people trying to make them more so and in a sense operate as reformers, even though when you're doing it early on, it sometimes seems more like you're a reformer than a reformer.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's going to be pretty incredible.
Yeah. I agree. I'm looking forward to it. I'm wondering if we're going to the first 500 years, where does that leave us in the end? Where are you going to hope to end at?
Right. I mean, it probably feels like at the pace I typically go that we might be able to end with the return of Christ, you know, but, yeah. But I'm thinking that, for our purposes, the first 500 years basically takes us through all of the ecumenical councils to the fall of Rome in the West and sets the stage for really kind of the next big era, which the rise of Islam and what we think of as like the Middle Ages, you know, precipitate. So the next 500 years, right up to the year AD 1000. I think that I would love to go through all of the history up to the Reformation and then to look at the Reformation and the post-Reformation kind of Puritan history as well. Whether we'll do all of that, you know, sequentially and in the same form, I'm not sure, but it's my hope that this will go well and that we'll have kind of an appetite to go farther and all that. Because in the same way that the first 500 years sets up a lot of questions, you know, and kind of answers a lot of things for us, there are some things that won't be answered. You know, in the first 500 years, we're going to have the development of the doctrine of the Trinity. We're going to have all of the thought around Christology, you know, the incarnation and the two natures of Christ and all of those things going on. But we won't have the iconoclastic controversy. We won't have like transubstantiation. That's not until, you know, 1200. And so there's a lot of things that won't have happened by the time that's done. So in that next era, a lot of things happen that are important for today. And so I'd like to keep going with it, but let's see how the first 500 years go.
500 years at a time.
Right. Exactly. I feel like we've bitten off enough to be satisfied for now. And we'll just keep going, as we go. But to be honest with you, the first 500 years, we probably have the least on, that we rely on fewer sources and we, skip over a lot of stuff. When you read a popular history, it's crazy how quickly you get from, the Book of Acts to the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah.
As if, it's a hop, skip, and a jump. And so I think taking the time on this will serve us well, and we'll be able to go into more detail than we would if we were trying to do, 1,000 years.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think for us especially, it's going to be great because we are a church that is always going back to those creeds. We're always making reference to the early church, the apostolic era, but also a lot of other stuff that happens in that first 500 years. And so I think that's going to be good. But also, people have a lot of questions about church government. How soon did episcopacy arise? How long did it take to get from a plurality of elders in the New Testament to like an imperial papacy? A lot of that stuff is worth thinking about. And also, how do I put it? It's our history too, and maybe this is a good kind of parting shot, but all too often people in the Protestant world have a tendency to think of our history as having begun in 1517 or having begun at Pentecost and then sort of gone into hibernation until Martin Luther or something like that. As if the history between then belongs to someone else, but it doesn't. I mean, the reformers clearly see the church before them as their inheritance, warts and all. Like, it's not perfect; it needs to be reformed, but it's not the church. It's not what they are dealing with, and so the church fathers belong to them as much as they belong to anyone else. And so that's a sense that I hope to develop as well.
Yeah.
That what we're studying here isn't someone else's history. What we're studying is our history. And we need to know it because it is our history. And it does make sense of where we are today.